Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft have signed off on a new set of principles for doing business in countries where governments interfere with the Internet. This effort started after the companies came under fire for collaborating with Chinese government censorship. In one instance, a Chinese citizen was jailed after Yahoo gave his information to Chinese police. We're going to talk now about the proposed principles with Leslie Harris, who worked on them. They're called the Global Network Initiative, and she's president of the Center for Democracy and Technology. And we asked what might be different from now on. Say that you're an Internet company. You've signed on to these principles, this code of conduct.
What are you going to do?
You're doing business in China, and the Chinese government asks you for contact information for people who have been doing something that is suspicious to the Chinese government.
I guess my disappointment with that is that we've decided this is not a China code, and everybody wants to make it a China code. You know, so you're picking the most difficult case and asking.
Am.
Well, go right ahead.
Well, humor me and tell me
okay.
what would happen in that situation.
Okay.
Then we'll talk about other situations
okay.
that might come up.
Okay.
Go ahead. What would happen if a company is in that situation, if a government comes and asks them for information,
well,
do they say no?
I think it's more complicated than do they say no. It's what have they been doing in the months and years leading up to that hard question. Because what we're asking companies to do is a different kind of risk assessment from the moment they make a decision to go into a country. So we're asking
them, meaning if you ever might be in a situation where the government is demanding information from you, maybe you'd reconsider doing business in China or Russia
after the
or
fact.
Someplace
that's
else?
That's after the fact. The question is, when you go into a country, what are your human rights risks? Are there particular risks for the kind of service you're going to offer, a blog service, an email service? How are you going to train your employees? So when that call comes, that individual on the ground understands what to look for. Has somebody senior in the company to respond to? Your goal here is to say, why do you want this information? Is this demand a legal demand under your own laws? A lot of times you get a piece of paper from some local entity.
Which might not be a legal demand at all.
Which may not be a legal demand at all.
Does the company have any leverage?
Individual companies have very little leverage, and I think we've seen that. If lots of companies take this approach, over time, we're going to be able to push back successfully.
Is it oversimplifying this to say this is only going to work if there are companies that are willing from time to time to give up some profits?
Yes. It's either not go into a country or more likely not offer a particular service that's considered particularly risky. Shall I, as Google made a decision in China, not offer email services because I think I can't protect people? Skype is a perfect example of this. Skype is a good company.
This is a phone service on the Internet. It can also be a video service on the Internet.
Yes. I don't think Skype ever considered when they signed a joint venture with a company in China. I don't think that they considered
whether somebody might be monitoring those phone calls. Have any companies that you've approached said, look, we don't want any part of this?
There are companies who have said, we have to think about this. This is a big commitment. We're not looking for real change in the next 24 hours. We're looking for real change over time. The Internet is at risk. Countries want to put their values, to put their laws, and to put their political systems in the middle of the Internet. So this is an ongoing collaboration. It will only work if over time we're able to bring many more companies into this process. And that means they do have to give up some control.
Leslie Harris of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Today, the Internet company Google is opening the doors to its new mobile phone operating system called Android. The system will allow any software developer in the world to create a program for Google's new phone. If the significance of this is lost on you, we've called our technology guru Mario Armstrong to help explain, as he often does. Mario, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Okay, so what's happening here?
Well, this is a big change. This is a major shift. Google has made this announcement called Android, and it's open source, meaning anyone can create for it. And that's significantly different than what Apple has done. You need to think of it, Steve, almost like it's its own platform. For example, Android, the operating system, is a platform for devices and phones. And if you think of it like Microsoft Windows is an operating system that runs on several computers, like HP, Dell, and Toshiba.
Yeah.
Well, Android is a new mobile operating system that could run on several devices like LG, Nokia, and Motorola. So more devices now have a new operating system, especially in the mobile arena, to be able to create applications on. And that's a significant difference.
This means anybody could take the Google phone and create a program that is a word processor or has a calendar or brushes my teeth or does anything else.
That's right. Takes a picture of you in the morning. I mean, it goes beyond that. Look, they already have some programs created for it that do those types of things. There's one called My Closet, which manages your photographs and information about the clothes you own, Steve. And help coordinate this and record your daily outfits.
Okay, what happens when I leave the phone in my other suit or something? I wonder if they could take care of that. I just want to know, though, how's this different from Apple, which is doing something very similar, isn't it?
Yes, they are doing something similar. They do have an application store for their devices, but Apple only has two devices, the iPhone and the iTouch. So programmers and software developers have been creating applications, but it's only available on those two devices. And it's kind of a walled garden approach. You have to pay to play, so to speak, and there's a criteria that you have to pass that Apple lets you in.
Oh, you have to basically apply for the right to do this, the ability
correct.
To do this. Google says it's wide open. Anybody wants to do anything, go ahead.
That's correct. And you still have to pay a smaller fee in order to provide your application through the Google system, but there is no criteria. Everyone will be allowed to have their application up in the store.
Is this something that everybody who sells any kind of phone is going to be doing pretty soon?
I mean, pretty much so. I mean, unless you really have a closed system that really works well, I mean, you're going to start seeing, right now you have over 30 companies that are already involved in what is called the Open Handset Alliance, and that is a group of everyone from manufacturers of cell phones to software companies trying to understand how they could use this platform in a variety of areas.
Does this mean that phone companies, given the way that people develop programs, within a matter of months, they're not even going to know what people are using these phones for. They're not even going to know where their profit is coming from.
That's a great question and an awesome point, because starting in the first quarter, that's when you can actually start seeing, in this particular Android marketplace, people making money off their applications. But you bring up a bigger point, in that you might start seeing internal technology organizations inside of other companies creating their own applications. They don't even necessarily need to buy anything from a store that someone else created. They could create their own apps for their own offices or their own businesses.
Mario, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Steve.
Mario Armstrong is Morning Edition's regular technology commentator and also hosts the radio show The Digital Spin on public radio stations WYPR and WEAA in Baltimore.
Both presidential candidates talk a lot about weaning America off foreign oil and adopting alternative energy. Well, here in California, that is already happening. Utility companies pay people who produce solar energy and then send the excess energy back to the grid. How much these companies pay, though, is the subject of some dispute. Rachel Miro of member station KQED reports.
This is for you.
The 2007 Sauvignon Blanc on the house at Cade Winery's grand opening in Napa Valley. Sipping a glass, green building consultant Bill Worthen stands on the patio overlooking neat rows of grapevines and thinks big thoughts about the future.
Green building is a step in the right direction, and now we need to move toward truly sustainable design or regenerative structures, and that's kind of the next step, and that's where net zero energy comes into play.
Net zero means the building generates as much energy as it uses by design, and Cade is a case study, one of the first net zero wineries in the nation. Built entirely out of concrete, steel, and glass, Cade doesn't need any air conditioning, a notable feat in hot, sunny Napa Valley. But even a winery built to minimize electricity usage has to use some juice. Which is why there are solar panels on the roof. This wouldn't be the biggest solar array at a Napa winery, but Worthen says Cade's could have been bigger.
So now if you'll notice, the size of the array is only half the size of the roof. The roof was about twice as big as what they needed to get their power bill to run back to zero. And the way the current structure is set up for ratepayers, PG&E will not give you a check back for power that you generate on your site.
Can you, say, out of the goodness of your heart, give them the extra energy?
Given the hundreds of thousands of dollars that it would cost to put in this extra solar array, I mean, I suppose you could, but what incentive would there be, even when somebody's heart is in the right place, to do such a thing?
Actually, PG&E does pay, but it's a complicated business, and the utility doesn't pay enough to make it worth the bother, Worthen says. He wants the state to require utilities to pay more for the extra energy. That, he figures, would encourage more solar-powered utility customers to reduce their energy usage in order to generate extra for the grid. It's not so simple, says the regulator in charge of solar for the state's Public Utilities Commission, Molly Sterkel.
We already have three incentives for consumers. We have the upfront California Solar Initiative incentive.
First, the utility covers about a fifth of the cost of the installation. For some commercial projects, you're talking about several hundred thousand dollars.
We exempt consumers from interconnection charges or fees or studies.
There's another few thousand dollars. Then, once everything is up and running, solar customers may never have to pay another power bill. When the sun is shining and they feed energy into the grid, the utility credits their account at a generous rate. When the sun's not shining, they pull energy off the grid and the credit offsets the cost. That's an awfully rich, ratepayer-financed set of subsidies, says consumer advocate Mindy Spatt of the Utility Reform Network.
The subsidies under the Million Solar Roofs program are largely going to some of the wealthiest zip codes in California. At the same time, working families in California are struggling to pay their electric bills.
But solar advocates in California say premium rates for customers like Cade that have extra solar to sell would take the state's solar portfolio from respectable to stellar. Germany began offering rich rates in 2000, and now the cloudy European nation boasts more than half the world's solar power generating capacity. More than three dozen nations have followed Germany's lead. The U.S. Congress and five other states are considering doing the same, all of which drives Spatt nuts.
Don't compare us to Germany. Germany also actually has social programs that will protect people when they're unemployed. There's child care, there's health care. So maybe the consumers in Germany can afford to subsidize solar because, in fact, they're already getting all those services. But here we're on our own, you know?
Not all consumer advocates agree with Spatt. Some see the growth of solar in all its forms, big and small, public and private, is a good thing for power grid stability. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.